started. Welcome, everyone. This is January 26th, 2006, and it is about, according to the clock on the wall over there, it is about 12 minutes after 3. And I'm going to call this Hess meeting to order and let the record show that Representatives Seaton, Coring, Gardner, and Cisna, and myself, Wilson, are all here, and Representative Gatto has already been excused from the meeting. So on our agenda today, we're going to move along real quick here. We have confirmation hearings of the governor's appointments for the director for the state medical associate or state medical board, and also for our commissioner of health and social services. So what we're going to do, I think, first, because we've got some people online, is to take care of our online appointees first. And so let's go to Dr. Kevin Tamara. Are you online, doctor?
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
You have been appointed to the State Medical Board, and can you just kind of give us a little bit of information about yourself and why you're excited about serving on the board, and then we'll have some questions perhaps from the members on the committee.
Sure. I've been a physician since 1978. I've been up here in Alaska since 1993. And obviously, being up here for such a period of time, I kind of feel it's my obligation to kind of return something to the community.
All righty. And what's your area of expertise?
Oh, I like to say I'm a plumber, urologist.
Okay. are there any things that you're specifically interested in when you join the board? Or do you have any kind of goals in mind or anything, or are you just going to kind of see how things go to begin with?
Oh, I'm much too new.
Okay. All right. Are any of the members, do any of you have questions at all?
No questions?
Representative Cisna.
Yes, Dr. Tamara, you are, I note, a medical provider in the university medical area in Anchorage. Put you in a rather distinguished place, I believe. That's my own view. And I have several, or actually it's basically one question. Are you familiar with the growing numbers of the uninsured in Alaska? And then kind of an addendum to that, have you been contacted or have you heard about the pro bono program that's being done in Anchorage? It's being done through United Way, pooling volunteer medical health providers to provide services for low-income, uninsured, and what might your interest be in trying to sort of reach out and help those Alaskans that can't afford health care?
Our group of urologists actually does participate in this pro bono program. We've always kind of taken care of people irrespective of their insurance, under insurance, or no insurance at all. Unfortunately, healthcare costs, even if you can afford insurance, even the co-pays have become kind of onerous for all Alaskans, not only the people who don't have insurance, but even the people with our healthcare costs went up 25% in September alone. We're paying $25,000 per month to cover our employees. And I don't think there's an easy solution.
We're working on it.
Thank you. Representative Seaton?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Tamara. What would be your analysis of the major role for the State Medical Board?
That is an interesting question, and I guess, like Dr. Fleming, I think that we should be in the practice of medicine and not in things that are not necessarily part of what's traditionally been seen as medicine. What's an example? I mean, for example, I don't think we should be, the medical board should not be social engineering. We should just simply uphold, it's hard enough right now to review and make sure that we get qualified candidates as well as to police the people that are here right now.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other hands up here, so I do believe that one of our members, you are one of our members' constituents, Dr. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be very happy to entertain a motion that the Health and Education Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Dr. Kevin J. Tomara, the governor's appointee to the State Medical Board, and to recommend that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Okay, and hearing no objection, so moved. And I will send his name around so that everyone can sign it. And thank you very much, Dr. Tomara. We appreciate it. And we have just sent you on to the next committee.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Okay, next on my list is Nancy Puckett. Nancy, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Again, I'll have you do the same thing, give a little introduction, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're interested in serving on this board.
Well, I've been in Alaska for 15 years, and just as my husband predicted, it got addictive to me. I've grown to love the state tremendously and the state's people. I used to work for the oil business, but I stopped doing that about 5 or 6 years ago, and I have been working closely with the nonprofit sector in the state. And I, like Dr. Tomara, just felt like I wanted to do something for this state. And a friend of mine suggested I apply to be on the state medical board, and so I did, and here I am.
All right. Representative Seaton has a question for you.
All right.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Puckett. Are there designated seats on the medical board for providers and for public members? And if that's the case, which seat would you be filling?
I'm a public member. There's two public members, and the balance of the board is made up of, I believe, 5 or 6 physicians and a PA, a physician's assistant. And then there are 2 seats for public members that are not associated with the medical profession.
Well, great. And
follow up?
Yeah, I'd just like to say thank you for your willingness to serve as a public member on the board.
It's my pleasure. You're welcome.
And Representative Cisna has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy Puckett, or I'm pronouncing your name wrong, but
Puckett, you did it right.
Oh, good. I note in your resume that in fact you've spent some time now working for Foraker Group, and of course Foraker Group is doing an enormous amount in the access issue. Trying to help Alaskans get better access. Can you maybe speak a little bit to your kind of what you think you can bring on the medical end of your membership on this board?
Well, I don't know what I can bring on the medical end because I'm not a medical professional. However, what I see my role as being as someone to represent the public on the medical board and to hear all the issues that come up before it and the different individuals that come up before the board who are applying for licenses or who are for some reason under some sort of an agreement or they've been reprimanded for something, and I am there to speak for the public and hopefully protect them.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Seaton?
Madam Chair, I'd move that the Health, Education, and Social Service Committee has reviewed the qualifications for Nancy Puckett for governor's appointee for state medical board, and that we recommend that her name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
All righty. Hearing no objections, so moved. Congratulations, Nancy.
Well, thank you.
And we will move this on to the next committee.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we have one more online. Ed Hall, are you there, Ed?
I am.
And Ed, you're a PA, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All righty. Why don't you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about what you do, and why you are interested in being on the board.
Okay. I'm a physician assistant, and I graduated in 1990, and I've been in Alaska since 1994, working in a family practice here in Anchorage. And since I've been up in Alaska, I became active with our Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants. And over the course of the years, we were, myself and another PA, had committed on behalf of our academy to attend the state medical board meetings because we felt as licensees of the medical board, we felt like we should have a seat on the board. So what we did to ingratiate ourselves to that board is we committed, our academy committed funds to send either one of us, and a lot of times both of us, to attend the medical board meetings to learn about what goes on, and also to, whenever PA issues came up, we just thought it was important for us to at least to be there on the sidelines to answer any questions. And then 5 years ago, we were successful in lobbying for that position and had unanimous support from the medical board and as well as unanimous support from the representatives that helped us with that bill to change the composition of the board. And I continue to attend the medical board meetings while the other gentleman that worked with me to provide that seat or to get that seat on the board. He became the first medical board member, PA medical board member. And then at the end of his four-year term, I was asked if I would be interested in that. And so I thought it, since I had the knowledge of what had gone on thus far, I thought it was a good transition. So I applied for that, and that's where I am today.
Great. Any other questions? Representative Cisna over there has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, Edward Hall, I would like to ask, sort of framing this in that I believe that your profession, physician's assistants, are an extraordinarily important partner in administering healthcare and healthcare management. And that, in fact, if in fact we're going to deal with not enough medical professionals, that your profession is going to be one of the important guides or the supports for finding solutions. You probably have some feelings about the lack of health professionals in rural areas in Alaska, and could you speak to that and your role on the board?
Actually, yes, ma'am, I could. I definitely believe that as a physician assistant, we definitely are that partners in that the whole aspect of medical care throughout the country, and particularly in Alaska, in the rural areas. And quite frankly, if my wife would let me, I'd probably be in the rural areas, but she's not too partial about the cold of Alaska, so at least she wants to be able to get out of here as quick as possible. But I do think that it's important that physician assistants become integral, and we have thus far been able to fill many of the underserved areas, outside the main urban areas in Alaska. And so I certainly support, and our academy supports the whole prospect, and you there was some talk of the pro bono opportunities. I do know of several PAs that are participating and that have heard about that, and we're actually in our clinic, we've actually talked about trying to implement something like that. I'm the solo provider in our clinic right now, so, and we've just moved offices, so it makes it a little stretch right now, but we are anticipating hiring someone in the spring, and then we're hoping to be able to be part of that program here in Anchorage. But I do believe that physician assistants can be an integral part in providing the underserved in Alaska.
Thank you, Ed. Ed, have you had a chance to visit any of the rural areas of our state?
I have. The company who I work for, we have physician assistants working up in the North Slope and down in Chimia, and we have at the Kensington Mine, we have people there. And so I've visited the Slope. I haven't visited Chimia yet. I haven't visited the Kensington Mine. I have been down to Unalaska, and I've been to some of the areas east of here, like Glen Allen, and some of we've got a PA that used to work for us there and been there and seen what setups they have there.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that, because I think you'll be able to serve the board better because you have an idea of what it's like in some of those rural areas. So thank you for doing that.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
I don't see any other questions. Can I hear a motion? Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health, Education, and Social Service Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Edward A. Hall, the governor's appointee, to the State Medical Board, and recommend that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Okay. Seeing and hearing no objection, so moved. Congratulations, Ed.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, we have one more confirmation, and that is someone that we all know. And this is for the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And she's acting commissioner now. So we have had a chance before you were deputy commissioner, and so she's visited our committee almost every time we have a committee meeting. And Carlene, why don't you come forward, Carlene Jackson, and come forward. And I have no idea what you want to say. Go ahead and give us a little spiel, and we'll see if anybody has any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of your committee today, and have enjoyed working with you all over the last 3 years. Somebody asked me today how I got to the position that I'm in, and I had to say that I'm an accidental bureaucrat. It was not something that I went after, but something that came after me. I've been privileged to be in Alaska for 40 years. My husband and I have been married for 33 of those years, and we've raised 3 children here. And I had the privilege of being home with those children in the early years, did a lot of volunteer work, kind of looked at what I wanted to do with my life, and found that I was passionate about Alaska and the people of Alaska. Pursued an education that included a bachelor's degree in psychology, a master's in human development, and eventually a doctorate degree in human services. And for me, human services was the pursuit that I finally followed, because it integrated and wove together all the different disciplines. Initially, I thought when I grew up, I'd be a child psychologist. And then I thought, well, but there's limits to that field. It doesn't really look at the whole picture. So I tend to be a person that likes to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And 3 years, now 3.5 years ago, when Joel Gilbertson called me and said, I'd like to talk to you about working as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, I said, oh, I don't think I'm really interested. And when he called a second time and said, well, just come talk to me, I thought, you know, he's the same age as my oldest child. I can't imagine, since I don't want to be a bureaucrat to begin with, that this would ever happen in my lifetime. But after meeting with him and talking to him for about an hour and a half, I really was impressed with his vision to transform state government and truly work to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. It's been a privilege to work with him and the management team that he put together in this department. And I can say to you, the reason that I was willing and able to take on this challenge is the management team that I have behind me. We not only have 3,400 incredible employees in the department, but our leadership team has a quality and an integrity that I've not seen for a long time, and it's a privilege to work with them. So that's kind of a short synopsis, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. That's good to hear. That's really good information for us to hear, because we meet everybody, but we don't really get to hear any little extra things. You know, it's always business as usual, and we go on, so that's good. I felt the same as you did about Joel Kimberson. He could be my son, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it just doesn't connect right, but anyway. So does anybody on the committee have any questions for her? Representative Seaton.
I have a question. I see a strong background in case management. Mm-hmm. And do you see changes within DHS that would be advantageous with changing case management, or do we need any changes in that strategy within all of the different departments that you supervise?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, what a great question. In our department, we've actually been looking at what we're calling family-centered services, and what we're doing is looking across our divisions at doing integrated case management, particularly for those individuals that are approaching their 60-month limit for welfare. And the reason being, based on my experience, we cannot have case management happen in isolation. And you're exactly right. We start with working across divisions, and then ideally we would work across state departments. So yes, I do think we can make some positive changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner. I have spent years sort of being involved also in kind of skirting around being involved in especially children's services. And I also worked for the state in 1975 in a department, and it was actually during a legislative session, but it was in working in the department. And I remember hearing the conversations about the commissioner that had just taken that position, and the fact that, and this was a conversation that was going on between middle managers, and talking about the fact that they probably weren't going to get very far, because it's the system that has a tendency to self-perpetuate, that in fact, and I certainly see this in terms of some of the things I'm hearing from my constituents, that many of the problems that I had heard about before still are there in children's services, and that you can change names and you can change people, but it's very, very hard to change the paradigm. And that's kind of what we have to do. Have you thought about that? It is kind of an attached question to Representative Seaton's question, but have you thought about how challenging this is?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Sisna, absolutely. And I believe I speak for most of my management team when I say they've also thought about it, and we've talked about it. If you look at the folks that we have that are leading our divisions and our deputy commissioners, most of them aren't long-term state employees. They come out of the private sector, they come out of the nonprofit world. And we have talked about the fact that trying to change the system is very difficult, but you can truly only do it from inside the system. And that's why we're committed to trying to make those changes happen. Certainly they won't happen quickly. I don't expect that by the time I leave this office, all the things I had hoped would be accomplished will. But while I'm here, I'll do what I can to make those system changes happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have a question. I just have an observation to make. I met with the commissioner in my office, and I've interacted on a limited basis over the last few years, and I must say that I'm impressed with her. I think she's very qualified for the job. However, we don't necessarily see things eye to eye 100%, but at least she's open-minded to issues such as certificate of need that we talked about today. So I think that's a good thing. I'd like to see the certificate of need law loosened a little bit to create a more competitive atmosphere, and I know that's easier said than done, but I appreciate her open-mindedness on that issue. Not that I'm suggesting that you're committing yourself to pursuing that, but appreciate you at least hearing me out and your willingness to be open-minded to that. So I'm ready to make a motion, unless there's any other questions, to forward her name to the next level.
I'm ready to entertain a motion, so.
Okay. After review by the House Hess Committee, I move that Carlene Jackson's name be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration for confirmation as Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. Congratulations, Carlene. We're excited that you are, at least as far as this committee is concerned, official.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, all of you committee members.
Next on our agenda, we have a presentation by Dr. Richard Monsager, and if you would like to come forward, and he's going to tell us about, I think we've all heard on the news about what happens if we have this word that's a pandemic, and this is kind of new in the vocabulary of most people, and so our Dr. Monsager is going to come up and explain to us exactly what this word means, and you may have some other people with you to help out. Just go ahead this is something that I'm very interested in as a nurse, and I was at a conference where I got to listen to the lady in Toronto. I don't know whether she was the head nurse, but I think she was the head nurse in a hospital where the SARS incident happened, where actually 47 people died, and they had it all contained. But all the problems that happened and what happened because of it, how it affected the people not only in the hospital, how it affected the patients and the staff, but how it affected the people in the town. And it was just like a mushroom that just, a wave that, talk about a tsunami wave. It was kind of like that, only it wasn't on the anywhere near water, and it just moved and it affected a lot of people. So I'll just be quiet and let you tell us all about it.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. And as you saw while you were talking, I was hoping that would have gotten fixed up there on the wall. It was up there while the other stuff was happening, and now when we wanted it, it decided to go to sleep.
A virus got to it.
I'm sure that it has a sleep cycle built into it.
Or it caught the flu.
Ken, I think it was Ken.
Well, while we wait to see, we can start without it, and so we will start, and if we get the slides back, it would be great. If not, we can talk without the slides. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here this afternoon.
Would you rather just take a little bit of it at ease, and that way you could do it the way you normally planned it? Because we're fine with that if you want.
That would be wonderful if we could take a couple of minutes.
Let's do that. Let's just take a little bit of ease.
Okay.
Not adjourned, but we will proceed, whatever.
So thank you so much for taking it at ease so we could get this working. Again, as I was saying, thanks for the opportunity to be here. And Dr. Butler and I intend to take about 30 minutes and to do this, and there's plenty of time for questions as much as you're interested in.
And I'll have, as we go along, if there's questions, just pipe up and we'll see. I think that's easier than waiting to the end.
Yep. I'd like to introduce Dr. Jay Butler, who's the new state epidemiologist and chief of the section of epidemiology. He joined us on November 1st. He's been in Alaska for 8 years with the Centers for Disease Control in charge of the Arctic Investigations Program in Anchorage, and came and joined us with the state. Jay and I have been talking for about 16 months, and it took a long time to work through the Center of Disease Control administrative processes to make this possible. But of all the things I've been able to add to the state over the last 18 months, I think as you get to know Dr. Butler, I think it's one of the most important things with the state to have somebody with his expertise to join us. So I'm just going to start with an overview, then Jay is going to talk about the science about these questions, what's pandemic flu, what's avian flu, and then I'm going to finish up talking about what's the government's role, what are our recommendations, where are we in our journey, and so on. So we're going to divide this in half. Here's our goals for what we'd like to try and accomplish in the next few minutes with you all. First, the first part is an influenza primer. This is the part that Jay is going to do, and then I'm going to do the second half, which is about preparations, preparedness, these words that you've seen floating around in the media, and where are we, kind of an assessment point, and where do we think we should be going, and where's the journey going to take us with businesses and communities and faith organizations and individuals. That didn't work.
Good afternoon. I'd like to begin by thanking the committee for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. Let's start with just what is influenza? Short answer, a respiratory tract infection caused by influenza virus. The two operative words there are respiratory and virus. Even though we all use the term stomach flu sometimes, that's not influenza. But we're talking about a respiratory tract infection. Oftentimes includes fever and muscle aches also, but we're not talking about some of the things that we call the flu. The fact that it's a virus means that it's not treatable with standard antibiotics like penicillin, but rather it requires special antiviral agents to suppress the virus replication if it's treated at all, and most cases actually aren't treated nowadays. It is spread by respiratory droplets. You see the rather graphic picture there, meaning that the droplets that come out of our mouths when we cough, we sneeze, even when we talk, can contain the virus, and that they can travel through the air distances of 3, maybe even as far as 6 feet, depending on how tall you are. And so it doesn't require direct contact for someone to become infected with influenza. The illness usually begins about 1 to 5 days after being exposed, and the person who is infected is infectious from the day before the day of illness onset for about then 3 to 5 days. There are 3 major types of influenza. Influenza A is the one that most often causes the annual epidemics that we have every winter, but it is also the one that causes pandemics, and we'll say a little more about pandemics in a few minutes, and it's influenza A that we're going to be talking about today. The other two, influenza B, occasionally causes winter epidemics. We have B years sometimes. We haven't had one lately. Influenza C is something that causes occasional illness. Most physicians don't even know about influenza C, so we all know a little more now than our doctors. Next slide. Influenza A is typed based on the molecules on its surface, and the names for those molecules are abbreviated as H and N, and there's 16 H types, 9 N types. We use that then for the nomenclature of naming the types, and you've probably heard of H5N1 is the bird flu in Asia right now. That's just an example. All influenza A types exist in nature in an aquatic bird reservoir. Ducks, geese, shorebirds, those birds are able to carry the virus. Occasionally, though, strains will go through the right mutations to be able to spread to other species. Just keep clicking there. And that includes horses, pigs, seals, domestic poultry. That's fine. The wildfowl generally do not become ill. Go ahead, next slide. But the other species, such as pigs, domestic poultry, the seals, do become ill, as do humans. And the physician is not practicing good respiratory etiquette there, but Dr. Monsager will tell you more about that in a few moments. Human influenza. These are the influenza A subtypes that spread widely among humans. They're primarily H types 1, 2, and 3. Currently, H1N1, H3N2, H1N2 are circulating. That's a whole lot of letters and numbers. Basically, what I'm trying to say is there's a limited number of types that cause human influenza. What's circulating in Alaska right now is primarily H3N2, for example. Avian influenza. As I mentioned earlier, influenza A is found mainly in birds and sometimes will spread to domestic poultry. There are two types of avian influenza based on the type of disease it causes in domestic poultry. Low pathogenic strains, the birds may have disease or it may be pretty mild. It may be manifest primarily as ruffled feathers, reduced egg production, if it's a broiler flock, reduced size. But then there's also highly pathogenic strains, which can have mortality in commercial flocks approaching 100%. These are primarily diseases and viruses of agricultural importance. But this leads to the discussion of H5N1, a little more on H5N1 avian influenza. It was first isolated from terns, shorebirds, in South Africa in 1961, just 2 years before Alfred Hitchcock made the birds. It circulates really globally in wild birds. H5N1 has been recovered from North America, but not the highly pathogenic type. The highly pathogenic strain emerged among domestic poultry in Hong Kong in 1997. And one of the things that we... Yes. Through the chair?
I'm sorry.
Representative Gardner.
Excuse me for interrupting. Are you saying that H5N1 strain can be not highly pathogenic and highly pathogenic, but it is the same strain, the same genetic structure?
It's the same H and N type, but the genetic structure itself may differ slightly, and that's part of what distinguishes whether it's low path or high path in the birds.
Thank you.
One of the things that was unusual about this high-path H5N1 in Hong Kong was that it also caused severe disease among some of the humans who had contact with these birds. 18 people were known to have been infected, and 6 died. The phrase bird flu is one that's oftentimes used to describe this illness that occurs in humans. In 1997, the virus appears to have been eradicated through containment of the infected flocks and destruction of a large number of domestic poultry. However, the virus reemerged again, a new strain of H5N1, highly pathogenic avian influenza, in Southeast Asia in December 2003, and has not been contained, but is in fact spread.
Is that the one that we're dealing with now?
Madam Chairman, yes, it is.
Okay, and so it stems back to 90.
Well, the strain that we're dealing with right now, sometimes called the Z clone, which is probably getting into more detail than either one of us is interested in, is what emerged in right at the end of 2003, so just a little over 2 years ago.
Okay. And it hasn't hit America yet.
And this strain has not appeared anywhere in North or South America. The H5N1 avian influenza in Asia has spread to human primarily through direct contact with infected domestic poultry or their secretions. There have been a few instances where human-to-human transmission may have occurred based on very mild illness, primarily antibody tests conducted among healthcare workers who were exposed to the patients in 1997. And there's one family cluster in Thailand where it appears that a child's mother very likely acquired the infection from her daughter. However, those at this time are still the unusual cases, and continued transmission person to person to person has not been documented. During 2005, the infection has spread fairly widely. This map is actually already a little bit out of date. The color coding indicates the countries that have had cases occurring among humans in orange, and during the past 3 weeks, cases have begun to be identified in Turkey. The number of countries that have had infected birds is at least 14. Human cases have been identified in 6 countries. Currently, we know that transmission from birds to humans is occurring in Indonesia, China, and most recently, Turkey. So why is this important? Why are we before you today if we're talking about pandemic influenza? A pandemic of influenza occurs whenever there's a new strain to which the population has no immunity at all. And that's the first ingredient in the recipe for an influenza pandemic. And H5N1 actually fits that bill. We don't have antibodies to H5N1. The second ingredient is the ability of the virus to replicate in humans and to cause disease. And as of Monday, there were 151 cases that have been confirmed, resulting in 82 deaths in Eurasia between that second emergence in December 2003 and this past Monday. The third ingredient, the one that's most concerning, is efficient and sustained person-to-person transmission. Unfortunately, that has not been seen with H5N1 yet. Now, the reason that pandemics of influenza are so concerning is some of our past history with pandemics. We think there's been as many as 10 influenza pandemics in the past 300 years. We know that there have been 3 during the 20th century. The worst in 1918 was quite severe. 1957 and 1968 were much more mild. If we look at the experience from those 3 pandemics and try to estimate what would be the impact of a new pandemic today, we can come up with some reasonable guesstimates, realizing that it's impossible to entirely predict the future. Based on those experiences during the 20th century, we think about 200,000 Alaskans would become ill over a period of about 12 to 18 months during the next influenza pandemic. About half of those people may seek care from a physician or a nurse or health aide in a clinic. Now, in terms of assessing the more severe illness, that's where it becomes much more challenging, because the 1918 strain was very bad in terms of the type of disease it caused. 1957, 1968 were a little more mild. But if we use 57 and 68 as the best case scenario, 1918 is the worst case scenario, we estimate that somewhere between 2,000 and 22,000 hospitalizations would occur. To put that number into context, there's currently about 1,400 licensed hospital beds in Alaska. Of those people who are hospitalized, we think 300 to 3,000 will require care in an ICU. About 150 to 1,500 would require mechanical ventilation, and that there would be 400 to 4,000 deaths, again, over a period of about 12 to 18 months. To put that number into context, during 2005, there were 3,200 Alaskans who died of any cause. So the worst case scenario would be that the death rate could actually double during the course of a pandemic. Actually, let's go back to that slide.
Madam Chair, Representative Garden.
Thank you. On the issue of fatality and how severe the illness is, if somebody in an Indonesian village, for example, gets the this illness, H5N1, would that the outcome of that specific case be different if that same person who got it in Anchorage, for example, and had access to IVs for solutions and hospital medical care? I mean, in other words, do we have effective treatment here that maybe would change the fatality expectations?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's an excellent question, one that I can't give a simple answer to. Most of the cases that have been diagnosed in Indonesia have been patients who have had access to health care, have received intensive care unit support, even treatment with antiviral drugs. Mm-hmm. So the cases that are being identified are certainly the ones who have the most access to health care. Now, it is also likely that it's the most severe cases that are being diagnosed.
Uh-huh.
For instance, the experience in Turkey, which may be a little more of a developed country than some of the other nations that have been involved, so far 4 of 21 confirmed cases have been fatal, so considerably lower than what's occurring in Asia.
Thank you.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question, another question is, between the 1918 epidemic and the 1957, mm-hmm. those two groupings of the less mild, is there a reason why, is the severity an issue of the kind of flu, or are there other factors that make the deaths more prominent? And then number two, are there specific populations that are more likely to get the flu?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Sisna, the primary determinant for the severeness of the pandemic will be the strain involved. For instance, we know more about the 1918 strain now to know that it created an immune response that was actually detrimental to the person who was infected. And it's thought that that may be one of the reasons why the 1918 pandemic was unusual, in that it was the vigorous and healthy who primarily were infected. The age group 20 to 40 really suffered the worst mortality. Very different from 1957 to 1968, where it was the very young and the elderly who were primarily affected in terms of severe illness, hospitalization, or death. The question about people who are at higher risk of infection, I'm going to, with your permission, interpret that as people who are at greatest risk for severe illness and death. It's a question for which there are very few good answers, particularly if we're trying to explain why that happened. I think for us in Alaska, the experience in 1918 is very concerning because the severity of the illness that occurred in western Alaska was among the highest that was seen in the world. There's certainly reports of native villages where mortality was greater than 50%. How can we change these numbers? I pose that as a rhetorical question. We have a number of tools in the public health prevention toolbox. The first thing that we usually think of for seasonal influenza is vaccine. However, in a pandemic, it's likely that a vaccine won't be available for at least the first 6 months. Second, we have infection control measures, and Dr. Monsago will say a little more about that in a moment. The third tool in our box is antiviral drugs. And the goal of the use of antiviral drugs is to reduce that number of patients who move from clinic visit down to hospitalization and further down the list, and also reduce the number of people who are hospitalized that move further down the list to require intensive care or who ultimately die. The National Pandemic Influenza Plan involves stockpiling of some 81 million courses of antiviral drug. However, responsibility for the stockpiling for about a third of that supply will fall to the states. In Alaska, we anticipate needing approximately 60,000 courses to treat persons at highest risk of hospitalization and death, and essential workers, that is, persons involved in pandemic response, such as healthcare workers, pandemic responders, public safety officials. Additional drug would be needed if we wanted to enlarge that essential worker list to include people involved in infrastructure support, such as people in the aviation industry, given our particular dependence on air travel in Alaska. The stockpile may also, over the years, need to expand to include other medical support supplies, such as IV fluids, IV tubing, and perhaps infection control supplies as well.
Chair.
Oh, sure.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Wasn't there just an announcement by CDC recommending not using a course of two antivirals? And what do in flu cases, and what is the effect of that on the projected regime for this?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. About 90% of the H3N2 isolates, which are circulating presently, causing seasonal influenza in the United States, have been found to be resistant against amantadine and rimantadine, two of the older, reasonably priced antiviral agents. So the CDC is actually recommending now for people with severe seasonal influenza, at least for this year, they should be receiving the newer agents, such as also Tamivir. The H5N1 strains that have been identified in Asia are also mostly resistant to amantadine and rimantadine. In fact, a couple of isolates have been identified that are resistant to all of the antiviral agents. To date, though, most are susceptible.
I have a question to follow up on that. And the amantadine, I mean, if you got that right away, I mean, boy, that really, I mean, you could see it, you knew right away that it was helping. But what about the newer one? Does it work that fast, and is it that good?
Yes, the clinical data are comparable. The safety profile is actually better. The challenges are, like the older drugs, to be most effective, they need to be given within the first 48 hours after illness onset. The biggest downside of the newer agents are their costs. They're considerably more expensive.
Okay. Representative Sisna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess at several briefings that I went to this last fall, early December, but I think this stuff becomes antiquated information pretty quickly when you're talking about these flu strains, is what it sounds like to me. But they were talking about not only health care workers and safety workers, but they were saying that children are actually one of the great spreaders and they're the ones who are out there spreading, and that actually trying to keep them well is one way to cut down incidents in their families, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
So,
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, you're absolutely correct. I like to think, as the mosquito is to malaria, so children are to influenza. And this is part of the reason why CDC has been expanding their recommendations for routine influenza immunization to include young children, because it's very clear that they are an early vector for influenza in the community and oftentimes bring it into the home. In addition to the clinical impact, I think we can anticipate economic impact on businesses. High rates of absenteeism due to employee illness, ill family members, limits on public transportation, school closures, just plain fear, a number of things may limit the availability for employees to be able to report to work. Possible restrictions on transportation and public gatherings could lead to a reduced ability to provide goods and services. Additionally, it could change customer demand for some businesses. It could actually increase customer demand.
I have a question here. When the lady from Toronto talked about what happened there, and she was telling just about what happened at the hospital, that people that were normally would transport things to the hospital wouldn't bring them to the hospital anymore, and so they didn't have the supplies they needed. I mean, it was really a crisis situation for them, and this went on for months. I mean, it wasn't just like, well, a couple weeks and it was over. It lasted a long time, and, you know, do we have things in place so that the things that she talked about, and that was the first time that it had happened, and so for them, they really learned a lot, and I think she's traveled around a lot now helping other people get ready for it. And maybe Dr. Monsagra is going to tell us how we're ready for it later. Okay.
Okay. We can wait for that question. Okay. That feeds into what we're doing.
Okay. Great. In closing my section of this presentation, I wanted to address a few common misperceptions about pandemic influenza. The first is that an influenza pandemic is overdue, and it's going to be caused by H5N1 bird flu. I call this the gambler's fallacy. That's actually an epidemiological term. Just because the roulette wheel hasn't landed on the red three for 10 spins doesn't mean that the chance is any greater on this spin. Go ahead. Second, we do not really know what the type of influenza is that will cause the next pandemic. However, we do have better technology to recognize the trends and what's happening in the viral world and among the, both the animals and the humans in parts of the world where we tend to see influenza mutating and causing new types of infection, both in animals and humans. If you will, the both the biotechnology and the communications is such that we have a much broader view over the horizon. We can see incoming. What we don't know, for instance, with H5N1 is whether or not it's going to score a direct hit. But we do have a much longer view than we've ever had in the past to be able to see what are the likely suspects to cause an influenza pandemic. The risk of a pandemic has been with us all along. However, past complacency really isn't an excuse for lack of preparedness at the present.
Has it always been, when there was a pandemic, did it always go from animals to people?
Yes. The this has actually changed since I went through my my medical training, but it's always been clear that the strains oftentimes acquire genetic elements from animal influenza. For instance, the traditional thought of how new strains emerge is that an animal will become co-infected with two strains at once, oftentimes the pig. And that actually appears now, using modern biotechnology, to be exactly what happened in 1957 and 1968. If you think of the genetic structure of the influenza virus as a deck of cards, when an animal is infected with two different types, that deck of cards can get shuffled and a brand new virus can be created. And if that virus is one that includes the elements that allow it to infect humans, a pandemic can occur. More, I can't say more frequently because we don't really know how often it happens, an animal strain will just on its own change enough to be able to infect humans. And that appears to be what's happened with H5N1. That appears to be what happened with the 1918 strain also. Somewhere along the line, through mechanisms that we don't fully understand, it also then obtained the ability to be transmitted person to person to person, and that led to the pandemic. So we know that there's at least two mechanisms by which these new viruses can appear. Another common misperception is that a pandemic is like a forest fire, that it can be snuffed out if it's caught early. I'd like to maybe raise a different natural disaster paradigm to think about. With influenza, given the short incubation period and the fact that viral shedding begins early after infection, it's in it, the ease of spread. For instance, if I was sitting here with influenza, I've probably infected Dr. Monsager as well as everybody I've shaken hands with so far today. It can spread rapidly. So that kind of rapid containment, if it's being able to be spread person to person, that is, if it's a pandemic strain, is highly unlikely. We probably should think of influenza as being more like a volcano, like an earthquake, like a hurricane. It is something that we can't stop, but what we can do is mitigate the medical consequences. And finally, a common misperception is there's nothing we can do about this anyway, and the federal government's going to take care of us. I think the experience with Hurricane Katrina makes us now chuckle at that concept. And I think the truth is preparedness is critical for mitigation, but up front, we won't have vaccines in our hands. Antiviral drugs may well be in short supply, particularly if the next pandemic occurs in the next year or two. But there are things that we can do, both individually and at the greater level of public health. And with that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Dr. Monsager.
Thank you, Jay. So one of the things of learning about pandemic preparedness is we could and should start changing the way we approach this yearly epidemic. Every year in America, about 30-some thousand people die of influenza, and we've just come to accept that as part of the cost of living in the United States. If we did these things, we could reduce the cost of that annual epidemic. When I tell my wife what I'm saying here about wash your hands or use a hand sanitizer and cover your mouth when you cough or sneeze, she looks at me and says, Dick, you don't practice what you preach. And so this is part of my own learning, is to start carrying an alcohol cleanser and doing this more often. We could all affect and change the spread of yearly influenza, and that would slow the rate of spread of a pandemic while we're trying to buy time for vaccine to be developed.
Okay, so I have a question then. So if we just have the sanitizer, that will kill it?
That's correct.
It's killed that easy?
So we should really all be carrying in our pocket one of those little bottles of sanitizer and using it regularly. My wife is an elementary school teacher. We've already talked about kids are the place of spread. They have a practice. She didn't know she was doing the right thing, but weekly they wipe down every single desk in their room and in their lunchroom, and I think a lot of schools do this now, between every shift in the lunchroom, they wipe down and use alcohol cleansers on the tables. There are a lot of things that we could implement in our daily life that would slow spread, and we would have an immediate payoff of less yearly death as we live today.
Representative Gardner.
Through the chair.
Related question. If I'm exposed, for example, and I have the virus on my hand, but I don't get it myself, can I then pass it on to the next person I shake hands with, even though I don't actually have the disease?
If you have the live virus in your respiratory droplets, even if you have some natural immunity, you've come in contact, you're spreading it, you're spreading live virus.
And if I shake hands with somebody who has virus on their hands?
That assumes that probably, if I do this or I use a handkerchief and I don't wipe off, that's correct. It stays on your hand for some period of time.
Thank you.
So what's public health's role?
I'm sorry, can we go back to that? I just want to make sure I read all that.
excuse me.
Representative,
when you say avoid tobacco smoke, that's not the same as smoking
the
tobacco.
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, a smoky environment makes it more difficult to clean surfaces. Stuff is there, etc. How would you answer that?
Yeah, no, I would just add to that through the chair, respiratory. Cigarette smoke is a respiratory irritant, whether it is primary smoke or secondhand smoke, and that can increase the adhesion of viruses to the respiratory epithelium. It can also result in respiratory compromise that we know can increase susceptibility to having more severe manifestations of influenza infection.
Okay. And you two fellows, Dr. J and Dr. Monsager, if you can at least say your name before you speak, because that helps her when she transcribes.
Okay.
So,
this is Dr. Monsager again. So let me talk now about public health's role. There are things that we need to be doing, are doing, and need to do more of. This picture is of a training exercise in a community using an annual flu shot exercise in a community here in Alaska to test and prepare in that community for doing rapid immunization of lots of people quickly. That's one of the things in terms of community preparedness. If and when we get into this, then both getting antivirals out, if and when they become enough available, we could use some for prophylaxis, and for sure when we get to vaccines, we're going to want to immunize people fast. And so communities need to be ready. We need to have confidence. We have partnership that we could do this in a big way fast. For example, in Valdez this fall, the last 2 years, every fall, we've used flu vaccine in communities. We've partnered with several communities to test and prepare. In Valdez, in 6 hours, they vaccinated 40% of the community, went and vaccinated the people on the cruise ship, and had enough volunteers and people available, they could have vaccinated 100% of the people in Valdez in one day. That's the kind of confidence we need to have in community after community after community in Alaska. There's surveillance. Oh, Representative Seaton, through the chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. The question I have is, the situation is almost counterproductive, isn't it, according to what we're saying is don't go to crowds and stay out of things, and here we're bringing essentially the whole population together to I mean, are we working on this so that we're not in a way in which you don't get exactly what we're generating of bringing the whole population together, and if someone is sick and doesn't know it, they spread it to all of the other people before the antivirals or vaccines would take effect?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think we need to keep track of two parts, and our planning involves two parts. One's a pre-pandemic phase, which is where we're at right now, and that's to be prepared that to be able to do this if we needed to. When we get to a pandemic phase and we then finally do have vaccines available, we will be 6 months or more into this. Lots of people will have been sick, and the trade-off will be at that time, yes, we're going to bring people together for one day while we vaccinate, the trade-off being we try and now stop this epidemic. But there's going to be a trade-off point in that discussion that absolutely, by bringing them together, some people will probably get exposed.
Also, this is the chair. I'm surmising that there may be populations that there's going to be pockets that there's, so far they haven't had one single, you know, person that's been affected. In those areas, you can just get everybody vaccinated and keep it. But there's going to be plenty of other areas where they know that it's there and they have to deal with it, right?
I think, through the chair, a corollary to this is polio vaccine in the 50s, when the disease was there in the summer, say, of 51, 52, 53, and you see pictures of these big, long lines of people coming to get polio vaccine. Yes, they came together, but it was the one way to stop this spread was to get people vaccinated, and people chose to do that.
Yeah, I can remember... They had it on a piece of sugar, or a cube of sugar, but I can remember that. But I was pretty little, but I can remember that. So
there's a lot of other things that are in the responsibility list of public health. Surveillance. As of a month ago now, if we got evidence that H5 had shown up in Alaska in a bird, then the anxiety would immediately build, could it be transmitted? We would send out an alert to doctors about if you see this group constellation of symptoms, you call Dr. Butler's staff, and we have capacity as of a month ago now to screen a small number of respiratory samples for H5, like we always do for H3 in our laboratory in Fairbanks. Over the next few years, and with last year's funding for the new laboratory, if we have 3 or 4 years by the time that we move to the new place, the capacity for widespread screening, and I think we anticipate that screening for all the known human influenza viruses will be routine in the future. So that's part of the surveillance responsibility. I'll talk a little bit about bird surveillance here in a little bit. Disease control policies and strategies we'll talk more about, because social distancing is a term I'll talk about in a few minutes, quarantine, isolation. There are lots of disease control strategies that we need to be talking about. And talking about with communities, I think one of my learnings about from Katrina is there's got to be a high level of public trust from communities and their community leaders and state leaders. If the public trust breaks down, this whole thing gets way bad, worse, as we saw with Katrina, quickly. And we have lots of people we need to engage as partnerships. Last year, you passed the new public health law, so we have isolation and quarantine authorities now that we didn't have before. Emergency plans. A lot of things are in place. 2 years ago, if we'd had this talk, we would have been saying a lot of we're on the verge of. Now we can say we have in place. We've tested our command operations center, using the standard incident management system during, for example, last August, during the statewide Arctic Shield Northern Edge, we activated our public health emergency operations center for the exercise and have tested now keeping it operational for a week. Investigations, the staff that work for Jay, routinely the investigations they do for all the diseases like norovirus and other stuff, that routine disease investigation is the training ground for preparation for disease outbreak investigation if and when this gets bad. Mass prophylaxis, I talked about in that previous picture. A pandemic flu planning. As of yesterday, the new edition of the pandemic flu plan for the state is posted on the website. We had the first version was published last March. The national plan was published in November. We've used this interval time period between November and now to integrate our state plan with the national plan, and that is now posted as of this week. That's now the template that we'll be using with communities around the state for planning and working together. Bird disease surveillance is a very hot topic in Alaska today as we speak, actually. There's a Migration Bird Council is meeting today, and they're in the last 3 weeks. I don't how many meetings have gone on. It's almost hard to keep track of, because Alaska is the center point of the United States bird surveillance plan for this summer, because there's no disease in North America. The bird flyways are Asia up to Alaska for nesting in the summertime. The current thought is the way this disease is primarily spreading across Eurasia is with wild birds. If it gets to North America in the wild bird population, then it will mix with birds from the California flyway, the Mid-America flyway, and will move south. The domestic poultry industry in the United States is petrified, to be honest, because this is where the big risk, even if this never becomes a human disease, it could be a devastating disease to the domestic poultry industry. So for this year, U.S. Geologic Society, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Department of Agriculture, most of their planning and surveillance will be in Alaska this summer. So that's been going on in partnership with DEC, with Fish and Game, with Native Tribal Organizations, identifying where, when they do banding studies and other studies this summer, where they're going to be screening the cloaca of wild birds. They're going to be involving natives in western Alaska, other subsistence hunters, both in the springtime egg gathering hunt and in the fall, and in the bird hunt season of looking at dead birds. They'll be using sports hunting dead birds this fall. So the surveillance across Alaska is a big activity. Now, the minute it gets to Alaska and gets established, if it does, then the attention will really move south, because then protection of domestic poultry is going to be really important.
Okay, I have a question here. This is the chair. So really, if it comes to the United States, it's going to come to Alaska first, probably.
Through the chair, the thought is if it comes by way of birds, it's going to come through Alaska. If it comes by way of sick humans, it could come to any place where an airplane lands, of which, again, Anchorage is one of the center place airports.
Now, I've heard on the news and things like that where they've destroyed all these birds in Turkey and in these other areas. So you can't eat them because the meat is infected, or is it you just killing them so that it won't spread anywhere else? Because I think people are losing their livelihoods and everything over this, right?
Through the chair, as Dr. Butler said, the way that it was eliminated in Hong Kong in 97 was by widespread culling of poultry, of birds of all types, and they eliminated the virus for a while, which is the strategy that's being used today in China, in Turkey, is trying to eliminate it from the local birds. It appears to a bunch of us that it is now established in so many places in the world that unless the virus changes itself, it's now established. But in an attempt to try and contain that spread, culling of domestic flocks is still the primary strategy that's being used in Indonesia and Turkey. And as you say, it eliminates livelihood, which is a big problem with reporting. The meat is safe if it's fully cooked. But what's happened in Turkey is, I think what would happen in this country is the domestic poultry industry in Turkey has been devastated this month because people are getting sick and they quit eating chicken. So even if it's safe, they quit buying. And it's happened in the turkey, in the poultry industry in Turkey. You hear some anecdotal reports from Italy and Greece that it also is people get scared and they start changing their buying habits.
Representative Gardner, and then Representative Sisson.
Thank you. But in order to prepare, cook, and eat it, you have to handle the raw meat, right?
There's the problem.
And Representative Gardner, through the chair, that I think is the concern is, and the science is trying to sort out what are the risky steps in that. Is it the defeathering, which appears to be one of the risky steps, which is an important issue for hunters? Is it the cutting of the meat itself, or is it the secretions and dust that's raised from the defeathering process, which is probably one of the major places in addition to eating undercooked chicken itself?
Thank you. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, we've got a lot done, but we've got a lot of things to do. And that, I think, as we head toward the end here, is what we want to use the last little bit to do. Faith organizations. If we get a pandemic, we're going to need volunteers in all kinds of ways in communities to keep communities going. And a lot of the volunteers will be recruited out of faith organizations, probably. So we need to work with faith organizations. How will we keep volunteers safe? What's the personal protective equipment? Where will it be stored? How will it be available enough if people are going to work in their communities to help keep their community going through this 8, 12, 18, 20-week time period of highest disease severity? Businesses and schools and communities, what's the planning? What's their exercising? Do they have it integrated into their emergency operations center? Do we know how we'll recruit volunteers to do prophylaxis clinics? Alternate care site is a phrase that we all in our world are really talking about a lot. Jay already talked about the fact that if we get disease of the 1918 type, we won't have enough hospital beds. We're going to have to care for the less sick people at home primarily, but in other places for when people can't take care of them. Who will those be? Where are they going to be? How are we going to staff them? What kind of equipment should they have? The first exercise in a community trying to test this will be in Ketchikan imminently, as they're going to test, trying to see could they recruit volunteers and other city staff to keep a small one of these operational for a few days, let alone for a few weeks. This is a very big deal that is going to require a lot of planning. The antiviral strategy, since our assumption is they're going to be in short supply to begin with, who gets them, what do we use them for, how do we get them to people, the prioritization. This is going to be an American word we don't like very much, rationing on the table. And so identifying in a public forum what's our prioritization is going to be really important. If you look at the plan that got posted yesterday, in one of the appendixes, it lists the proposed distribution of the treatment side for how for the sick people and healthcare, protecting healthcare workers and so on. A very much bigger issue is what Jay was talking about in the essential workers to keep communities going. Who are they? How many? What industries? And do we use them just to treat them if they get sick, or do we use them if they've been exposed? What about their family members that get concerned if my spouse is working for an airline industry and I become concerned that that's how the disease is spreading, am I going to want my spouse going to work? As we get further down the road and the capacity of antiviral production grows, then the prophylaxis question, who should be treated for weeks on end and how much, becomes important. So this is going to be an evolution plan over time as the antiviral drug availability changes, as the worldwide production capacity revs up in the years to come.
This is the chair. I can even see where, I mean, we could have violence here where people break into some place and take it, and I mean, all kinds of things could happen because people, fear is such a huge emotional driver that there will be things like that happen probably.
Through the chair, I think that's a big part of why we think we're on the speaking circuit right now, is to be talking in communities, to try and engage as many people about this, to think about exactly this question. I think all of us are more worried about this today, post-Katrina, than we might have been in August. A planning assumption in Alaska's emergency operations out of the big earthquake in 64 is public order will survive. That's a planning assumption that is written into Alaska's emergency operation plan. How much confidence do we have about that today after Katrina? I think a lot of us are a little bit shook about that planning assumption. And we don't have enough police to maintain it by force. This is going to have to be a trust relationship in communities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you. We're so far over here. This is, I don't know why, how we get this grouping, but here we have clusters, right? This might be, this cluster is resistant over here. Oh, no.
Resistant's a good idea.
Okay. No. I take that back. You know, one of the things I'm really concerned about on this, and maybe you go on and talk about it, but in the travels that I've had and talking to different communities about their healthcare systems and finding out as I go the growing number of uninsured, and the growing number. Now, in some instances, there's in the tribal health communities, some of the communities out there are doing some really incredible things, and there's great stuff happening, but there still are pockets of people who don't have real access to health care. And those people and what the providers are saying is that they're, in some cases, as people start falling through the cracks, they come in less. They distance themselves from the help, and I assume that this is maybe, you know, I don't know what the reasons are, but I would assume some of it is denial. The fact that if you feel like you can't afford it, then you just distance yourself because it's less painful to just blanket out of your mind. But that kind of problem and that kind of not having solved the problem of these huge the huge difference between our health indicators in things like alcohol, in the fact that we have some real holes in our system because of behavioral choices like tobacco. I mean, you're talking about tobacco smoke, and we lead the nation in that. And we lead the nation in these things. I'm positive it fits into this, and it's part of what we have to deal with, I think, and I guess it's a question.
Representative Sisna, through the chair, just a couple brief comments, and we'll come back to that in a couple places. One is, one of the big learnings nationally out of Katrina is paying attention to special populations, people that don't read English, don't have access to media, don't pay attention to media, live in isolated circumstances. That's going to be a big issue in this, and it is an evolving, bigger and bigger issue with us as we do our planning. For example, in Anchorage and their planning, special needs shelters, how do you reach people? The communication strategies are going to have to be in multiple languages. If you talk to hospital leaders, one of their big concerns is, who's going to, if we have this many sick people and we have uninsured and underinsured and so on, who's going to pay for all of this care side? My answer is, I don't know, but the country's going to have to wrestle with it nationally because it'll be a national problem that is going to go on. Now, paying for businesses, if your business goes away, do you keep people on the payroll? I mean, there's all kinds of business implications and economic implications. So this isn't only a medical issue. This is a social, economic, medical issue that if you read the literature from 1918, it is very sobering. But I'm going to come back to that question a little bit. I just want to make a couple.
Representative Seaton, you had a question.
Well, I guess I'd just like to focus on, you know, if we're talking about antivirals, effective antivirals being 6 months or 8 months away or something like that after a pandemic would start, it seems like that the things that we need to look at is if transportation is going to be interrupted, you know, are masks effective? And how many million masks do we need? Mm-hmm. I mean, because, you know, we say, oh, well, we'll have masks on people, but all of a sudden there are no flights bringing masks up here because they're all being used in Washington or, you know, Oregon or someplace else that flights would originate from. And hand sanitizer, you know, we talked about, oh, we should be doing, well, you know, unless we have supplies or some stockpiles of those kind of things here, our basic usage isn't. I mean, it seems like instead of concentrating on vaccination, which isn't going to be for, as you said, probably at least 6 months into a into this infection, we also need to concentrate on the stockpiling the things that we're going to need immediately. And are you going to address that a little later here?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's a great lead-in. I'll just touch on a little bit, and I'm going to come back to that question because in the governor's budget, antiviral medications is a proposal, and just one little bit of correction what you said. Vaccines we anticipate being or not being available for 6 months or more. The current plan is to build an antiviral medication stockpile now in states and federally so that we can at least treat people that get sick. But where your question goes to is what should be in the stockpile in the states and I would argue in the communities of this kind of stuff so that we can if our goal is to mitigate disease effect, we want a slow spread until vaccines get here. And this is a big part of the strategy. And when I get to the governor's budget, I want to make another comment about that.
Thank you. This is the chair. I have, my question is, a lot of the things we need to just start, I would think, start making it happen in our everyday life. And here in this building, it's probably the biggest, because if it ever gets starts spread by people, we're in the perfect situation for that to happen. Mm-hmm. Here, right in during the legislative session.
This is the mixing place for the state.
Yep, and so, you know, the sanitizers for your hands to do it every once in a while, you know, and in our bathrooms, they're there now, you know, and that is fantastic. This is the first year it's been there, and that is nice to just to be able to use that, you know. And so, you know, we're starting, I'm just very proud that some of the things are just starting. I mean, we can't do it all at once, but if we get used to, you know, it's make it a habit. You know, you can't remember to do things until you do it enough that it becomes a habit, and we have to kind of start protecting ourselves in little ways like that. Just start getting used to doing that, I would think.
Absolutely.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I hate to be asking or commenting so much, but in the various trainings, and I think I've been to four or five outside discussions on this issue in the past 6 months, and always has been mentioned the fact that the vaccines may or may not work, that the kind of influenza that hits us may not be the kind that we've got vaccinations for. It might be better than nothing, but it might not actually be really good for what we're getting. Isn't that a problem?
Sisna, through the chair, the reason we talk about at least 6 months is because a novel virus that Jay talked about means we won't have immunity and we don't have any vaccines that have that virus in the vaccine. And the current technology with eggs takes a minimum of 6 months to grow and do it. Part of the president's initiative is to try and change the technology such that this time can shrink. That'll remain to play out to see if this federal investment that was just in the budget at Christmas time will help leverage a significant change in the production technology.
Is there an expiration date also? I mean, I'm thinking of what we're going to try to have on hand. Does that have to keep going changing because there's an expiration date on it?
Through the chair, absolutely. The current timeline for Tamiflu, which is the majority thing that we're proposing to put into the stockpile for antiviral drugs, has a 5-year lifespan. And so this is not going to be a one-time only investment. It'll have to be cycled. There's some talk that the FDA is looking at length that does last longer than 5 years, but it'll have to be cycled into the yearly winter epidemic treatment cycle and replaced over time. One last thing on this slide. You are going to hear the phrase social distancing in this discussion. Quarantine and isolation, we talked about last year with the bill. Social distancing is a term that's now being used a lot because it implies both mandatory, which is kind of what quarantine kinds of implies, and a lot of voluntary activities. Does one advise not traveling unless you need to? Go to the grocery store at night late when there's less crowds. There's lots of personal behaviors that could be advised if we get into this that would help diminish person-to-person contact. But it also includes the mandatory stuff. Schools can be closed. What are going to be the triggers? What absenteeism rate? But if you just close schools and leave the malls open, have you accomplished anything? In certain neighborhoods, kids get a majority of their calories at school. So if you just close schools without and the parents aren't at home to take care of them, you have both unsupervised kids and unfed kids. If businesses don't allow work from home and the moms can't take care of the kids, they keep going to childcare. We've already talked about that's the place it spreads. So this social distancing is a very complex social discussion. And again, it needs to start at the local community level to say, how would we wrestle with this in our community? So in your handout, there's a couple documents. One is an administrative order from a couple weeks ago signed by the governor, which is a direction to all the state agencies that DMVA and DHSS are the lead agencies in planning and directing the other state agencies and departments to work together as we increase the state part of the planning. And that leads into then the next document you have, which is State of Alaska Pandemic Influenza Preparedness Concept Plan. The first, these are the planning assumptions that are in our current preparedness planning that we need to be prepared for. And there's a couple important points that haven't come up yet. One is the most likely way it's going to get here is going to be by some human on an airplane, that it will have started someplace else in the world, human to human. We will have some advance notice it's coming, that we aren't first. By the time it gets here, the ability to depend on national support will be greatly diminished. If we're first, there'll be so many federal folks here and so many federal agencies here to help, it'll just be amazing. But if we're 2 months into this, by the time it is way north, the national resources will already be overwhelmed, and we're pretty much on our own, and we've got to be prepared to do the best we can in the state. And so our planning assumption is we've got to be prepared to operate in that scenario. As Jay said, we've got to be prepared to operate for a bunch of months, and the healthcare facilities are going to be overwhelmed, that there's going to be lots of personnel shortages in every business as it peaks. If you look at 1918, it was about a 12 to 16 week time period that it would move through a community. Then it would go down, and then in many communities there was at least one more wave, in some communities two more waves over that 18-month time period. And that we should be planning at the present that there's a shortage of antivirals, and rationing is a part of the planning. So these are the objectives of the concept of working together, and both state, local, and some non-governmental organizations will be working together in moving us forward as a statewide plan. These are the four basic parts of the objectives of working together in this planning. As I said, the second edition of the influenza annex, which is it's a document that's an annex to the state emergency preparedness plan, was completed this week. We've talked a lot about education, about outreach and training and exercise. So what we're trying to do is we're now leveraging the involvement of more than just us now and a few communities, is now really trying to take this statewide in lots of communities at the same time by working together with the MVA in the leadership role, and then with guidance from a bunch of different agencies. Jay and I talked to Commonwealth North last week, and I'm going to talk to Rotary here in Juneau in a month, and we're trying to find more business opportunities. When we talk to business leaders, there's lots of things that they need to be thinking about. Is who are their essential workers, which leads the first question before that is, what are your essential services that you've got to protect at all costs to keep your business in place? And in the case of, if I talk about the Division of Public Health as a business, what are our absolutely essential services that we've got to protect and keep going? A lot of it is going to be in JSHOP, it's going to be in the public health laboratory, it's going to be public health nurses. Some of our other functions become much less important in this and wouldn't be in line for treatment with rationed meds if we don't have enough. And every business in Alaska should be thinking about that question. How are they going to try and reduce contact? Their employees will get sick with contact with non-employees, but if they don't do business, they go out of business and they've got no income. This is tricky territory, and there are some lessons to be learned from previous pandemics. We should be encouraging annual influenza epidemics with the hope that we have a 1957 or a 1968 one, where probably there was some cross-protection from previous vaccinations. But just last night, it looks like next year's flu vaccine will have 120 million doses available. This year there were about 90 million in the United States. So clearly, as interest in this subject revs up, the production capacity is slowly revving up. And the last bullet is what you were talking about, Representative Sisna, which is how do employees get access to care to get back to work as quick as possible.
Okay, this is the chair, and I'm thinking that for your department and that you're trying to get it out, when each of the people like AML, when they had their conference, you know, are you trying to, they've got all their people pulled together for the conference anyway, are you trying to meet with do a presentation to each group, or how's that working?
Through the chair, AML is a great example, which they had their Anchorage meeting in December. We tried to get on the agenda, and it wasn't a high enough priority issue. So I think a lot of what we're doing this winter is by talking to lots of organizations. We've got to raise the public awareness of this subject. One way this is the public awareness is going to raise is on April 13th, as of this morning, what's being called a Secretary Pandemic Flu Summit will be held in Alaska. The Secretary announced in early December, Secretary Leavitt of HHS, that he wanted to go to every state in the country to try and help elevate awareness and knowledge. Now, the way it's playing out is what you might expect, is it's not the Secretary coming all the time, it's undersecretaries or deputy secretaries or so on. But as of this morning, that date will be the date that Alaska, it's going to be just 3 or 4 hours. It's going to be a lot of what we've talked about today. Vermont had one two weeks ago that I think was quite helpful, a format in which they got industries, similar industries, to talk together. What are you guys doing around essential services? And they got regions together, cross industries. That format, I think, could make sense for Alaska. But it's just one more way of trying to raise the public discussion around this issue. Because yes, we need to get to as many forums and places as we can possibly get to try and get people to put this on their plan. Now, when you talk to a business leader, they got lots of things to do to occupy time. And so somehow we're trying to persuade people that this planning activity for something that may not happen in their lifetime is worth their spending time on. That's a hard sell. During a pandemic, then people will be focused. But then this first bullet becomes really important, and it would be nice if you've done it before this, which is, what are your sick leave policies? I think this is going to take an incredible culture change in America. We as Americans value heroes. You drag yourself to work if you feel crummy, right? That's the usual way we all operate. In this scenario, we want people to stay home if you're sick. How do you change that culture in a business, in a community, in an organization? That will be really hard. I had one business leader come up to me last week after I talked to Commonwealth North, and he said, good idea, won't happen. He was just very blunt. Restricting business travel. There's lots of things that could be done to diminish that. But think about the effect of reducing business travel on the airline industry in this state. That has a huge economic impact if we give that advice. And then for right now, the other reason to try and engage business leaders is there are some businesses that are ahead of others in this state. And if we can get people talking and sharing their stories, and in some ways, Alyeska and the oil companies, with how they maintain their pipeline camps, are ahead of us. They really have a lot of in-practice operation to minimize the effect of the wintertime epidemics, because in that closed environment, once influenza starts, they quickly can have a whole bunch of people really sick. And so there's a lot we're meeting with them with Alyeska in the very near future. And partly, I hope we can engage business-to-business discussion of learning from each other, too.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that I found fascinating in going out to the Aleutians this fall was Eastern Aleutians tribe, which I actually have spent some time since then following some of what they're doing with their Polycom. I don't know why we're not getting into something more like that in terms of the state, because they can get up dozens of sites on the screen, and the person who's talking, it jumps up so that you're actually seeing that person talk, but you can still see all of these other groupings, and they do their school boards. They have to do it because it's cost prohibitive of getting their folks together. So they have all multiple communities, and you see all of these people, you see dozens and dozens of people on the screen, and you can watch the person talking and then the person that answers. We should be doing that here. And there's a real serious problem in us not being able to do the same thing here. But you have that kind of technology, it's there, and that's one of those things that minimizes people needing to be physically somewhere. And in terms of, we've got all of this internet stuff that's going on, the technology is really there. We're really lucky in a lot of ways that it's a matter of really pushing to make sure that we're getting the last pieces in place, the habits in place, the making sure that people really use it. But we really are further along
And I thought we were really in some of that kind of thing.
And I'm going to make a comment because there's two of us that have another committee at 5, and so we need to kind of hurry.
I'll be done in 2 minutes.
Okay.
So talking about next steps, community leadership, we talked about future legislation. We're not ready yet, but there's the issues about liability protection for volunteers. If the standard of care has to drop to an alternate care site, how do we do liability protection? There are issues that we should be talking about in the next year around that.
Would that be like Good Samaritan laws and
something
stuff
like that? Of extending it in the case of a governor's declared emergency or something, some of that kind of stuff. This is what's in the budget. I'm not going to talk much about it now. There is a significant investment to improve our preparedness as a state. We've talked a lot about the antiviral need. This is the amount of money that is proposed in the budget for our contribution. Jay talked about what's the expectation of the state. This is buys the expected amount of antivirals for us to partner with the federal government in the antiviral, but it's in the operating budget, and I fully expect at the budget committee next week the question will be how come it's in the operating budget, not the capital budget. The reason is exactly what Representative Seaton commented on. It's not just antivirals, it's all the other preparedness stuff that really should be in communities and ready to go, and it will change over time, and stuff will outdate. And so this is a question that gets at the question that was in a Wall Street Journal last 2 weeks ago, talking about the difference between just in time versus just in case. All of business is built the last 30 years on just in time inventory. What is created is all of us in America are exquisitely vulnerable to our supply chain getting interrupted. The military does some just in case stockpiling, and what we're talking about here really is the government role in just in case, because it would never make business sense for businesses to really be doing lots of stockpiling. And this really starts us into that public dialogue as to what's the appropriate governmental role in just in case. In summary, we've already talked about all of this, that it's likely that there will be it'll happen sometime. We're better prepared. We've got a lot to do. The work we do for a pandemic, even if it doesn't happen in our lifetime, helps us in case we have a tsunami. Everything we do will help make us better prepared for the natural disasters that we know will happen in this state at some point in the future. And you and the legislature really play a significant leadership role, and we hope you'll partner with us. And when you go to community meetings, asking people in the community, are they planning for this, and so on. The website that's there right now is a little different than in your handout. This gets you to all of the resources around pandemic flu. We've now coordinated and collapsed together that you can get to avian flu, you can get to the plan, you can get to national checklists, you can get to all of that through that website now. And with that, we'll stop.
Thank you very much. That was very informative. Every time I hear about it, even though I've heard about it before, I learn something. So it's kind of something that most people, you can't take it in all at once. I mean, there's just so much, it's like a ripple effect. It's amazing the effect that kind of ripples outward to businesses and everything else. Does anyone have any questions? If not, we thank you very much for coming and presenting this to us. I'm going to search for businesses that will let you come in and do this. So,
if you want to read a book, this is the book that the reference is up there. This is about 1918.
Oh, okay.
And it is a very good but worrisome book to read.
Okay, thank you very much. And having said that, we will adjourn. Thank you.